Accession number 15240, Reel 3.
Mr. Hamilton, Reel 3. You were just telling me about the shipwrights up to their chests in water.
Yes, the shipwrights were, and the soldiers who were accustomed to oxyacetylene equipment, were standing in the bottom of the dock as the water came in, desperately trying to weld patches onto the holes in the hull so that the ship, so that the water could be let in and the ship could be floated again. To cut a long story short, this was finally successful and the water was let into the dock and the ship did just float. Shortly after this, during the it was decided that the Penelope should sail. I cannot remember the exact words, but I think Churchill made some signal to the effect that Penelope is to sail and fight it out in the open sea. Marvellous language. That would, of course, be very much better than lying in dry dock and just being pounded by bombs until the inevitable happened. Eventually, the captain had been wounded by bomb splinters. This is Angus Nicol, and he was ashore being looked after by a first aid post. The commander was ashore deciding how many sailors it would need to take the ship to Gibraltar so that the rest could be left behind in safety. There were no other officers. The gunnery officer had been killed, and I was found myself in sole command of the ship during the final air raid. This was, if I can put it that way, an enormous privilege to be in such a position. I have, which I can show you, a copy of the official report to the Admiralty, which I have in the house here, describing those last few moments in the words of Captain Angus Nicol. We had run out of 4-inch ammunition, and I managed to, this is during air raids, I managed to get a team consisting of soldiers, dockyard mates, civilians, and some of the Penelope's crew to form a human chain from the armament depot to the ship. And we embarked quite a lot of 4-inch ammunition. Unfortunately, a lighter full of ammunition, which was damaged, that is, the ammunition was damaged, was sent to us, which of course wasted an enormous amount of time. But we did embark enough ammunition just to last during the subsequent trip to Gibraltar. Eventually, the water was led into the dock and the ship just floated. And as darkness fell, Penelope sailed with the hope that she would reach Gibraltar, where she could be patched, and then she could be sent to the United States for major repairs. There is a small incident that maybe I should or should not mention. The only dishonorable thing, or perhaps that is the wrong word, that I've ever known done by any member of the British Navy, and that is that when we passed Cape Bon, we hoisted an Italian ensign, and we could all imagine the lighthouse keeper, who was a good spy, looking up his silhouettes and saying, "That surely is not an Italian ship." It must have given us 20 extra minutes, which was vital in getting the ship towards Gibraltar before she could be attacked again by aircraft. She was in fact attacked by aircraft but survived. As the Penelope entered the dry dock in Malta, she sank on the blocks, and Angus Nicol, the captain, cleared lower deck and he read that marvelous prayer thanking the Almighty for deliverance from the enemy. And as I'm sure you know, the words in that prayer include, "Make us as mindful now of thy mercies as we were then of the danger," which of course so describes the attitude of so many of us, that we don't pray until we have something for which to say thank you. It was an inspiring moment, and the love between Angus Nicol, who had done so much and was such a brave man, and his ship's company was a privilege to witness.
So then you were in Malta awaiting another ship?
No. From Gibraltar, the Penelope was patched again, and she finally sailed for Brooklyn Navy Yard. And I was still in the ship when she arrived there. It was interesting. The reaction of the dockyard mateys in Brooklyn was interesting. They all arrived in their Cadillacs with their caps on backwards and whatever. And they, when the water was pumped out of the dry dock in Brooklyn, they all looked at the propeller shafts, which were riddled with holes. And I remember now one of them saying, "Gee, I guess that's British steel." It is amazing that there was a scare on the way across the Atlantic, and the Penelope in fact increased to full speed, and although her propeller shafts were riddled with holes, she managed, the propellers stayed on, and we managed to get to New York.
What happened to you in the USA?
Well, maybe I could mention something else which is amusing. I happened to be in the Admiral's cabin while I was visiting an American warship, and the captain had just ordered a taxi, and a sailor came into the Admiral's cabin and said, "Say, Ad, can I bum a ride?" I think that is absolutely fantastic. It shows both sides of the relationship between the American sailors and their officers. This is no time to make such a comment, but I'm going to make it just the same. At the beginning of the war, we were somewhat suspicious about the United States Navy. It was all bull and everything. But by the end of the war, my God, we did have respect for them. They did a fantastic job.
I think you got your next ship in the USA, the Montgomery.
Yes, when I came back to England with the Penelope, and I went to the Admiralty and said, I saw Commander Denays, who was NA2SL, and I said to him, "Sir, I would like a job," and I was appointed to the Newport, which is a four-stacker repairing in Southampton. And the work was so slow that I had to go back to the Admiralty and say, "Look, this won't do. I'm not doing anything, just waiting for the ship to be repaired." And they gave me the Montgomery. Now, the Montgomery, unlike all the other four-stackers, had not been rusting in Chesapeake Bay since the First World War. The Montgomery had been part of the U.S. Coast Guard, and she had cruised up and down the Atlantic coast of the United States with some old sweats greasing the engines and keeping her in first-class condition. And she was, amongst the old four-stackers, quite unique. Her engines were in excellent shape, and the ship was terrific. She would do 33 knots without turning a hair. Commander Denays said to me, "Boy, you are very young, but we have no destroyer captains and we are desperate. "Do you think you can drive this ship?" And I said, "Yes, sir, I will do my best." And I was appointed to the Montgomery and sent to Liverpool to pick her up. We got out of Liverpool without hitting anything and reached Halifax, Nova Scotia. Before I had even got the ship alongside, there was a signal from CNC, Canadian North Atlantic, ordering me to report to him. I went ashore and reported to the Admiral, and he said, "Boy, you have to take charge of escort group W6. There are two destroyers, yourselves and a Norwegian destroyer, and four or five corvettes. You will be leaving New York very soon with a convoy. Good luck." I was, I think, 26 or thereabouts, or years of age, and there I was, senior officer of an escort group, of which all the commanding officers were senior to me. An extraordinary situation. But as they were bank managers and other distinguished people of that type who had done their courses and learned how to sink submarines on the instruction tables but had no experience whatever at sea, I had a very difficult job as a senior officer of a group where all my captains were senior to me, but at the same time I was the only one who had any sea or war experience. I have to admit that I did something slightly offside, but I was following Nelson, who you may remember, when he arrived at the West Indies, hoisted a senior officer's pennant to show who he was, in spite of the fact that there were other officers senior to him in the harbour when he arrived in the West Indies. I sent for my yeoman of signals and we made a senior officer's pennant, which is a small pennant with a red cross on it. And in Halifax Harbour I hoisted one of these, much to the amusement of everybody. And we did shoot a big line. We trained the Canadians unmercifully and they became very efficient. I used to take the Montgomery alongside in Halifax with three fresh eggs in a hairnet suspended over the side, just to show these chaps how ships should be handled. This is a terrific line shoot, for which, in fact, I make no apology, because it led to a good deal of merriment. Perhaps I should add that the four stacker is a very difficult thing to handle because they are so narrow that their screws are close together. And if you go full speed ahead with one screw and full speed astern with the other, it has practically no effect whatever if you're trying to turn the ship. So they are not easy to handle. However, I hope you will forgive me for shooting a line which is done with the best of intentions. Before very long, I was privileged to leave New York Harbour with an escort group of six and 144 merchant ships as a lieutenant, I think aged 27. It was quite a moment. You may know that at the beginning of these convoys, before they left harbour, there was always a convoy conference at which the skippers of all the merchant ships were assembled, together with the commanding officers of the escort, and the local admiral would introduce everybody to each other, and the commodore of the convoy, who would usually be a 70-year-old ex-merchant skipper of vast experience, some of whom had been sunk at least three times already and picked out of the Atlantic, these lovely old gentlemen would take charge, and they would say, "Are there any Greeks present? Because we don't want any smoke to give away our position," and so on. And then the admiral would say, "And now, gentlemen, I would like you to meet the senior officer of your escort." And Joe Bloggs, aged whatever it was, 27, would stand up, and there was a gasp from all the experienced veterans that their safety lay in the hands of one so immature. However, we did leave it. I've never forgotten the sight of 144 merchant ships leaving New York. It was really quite something which I will never forget.
Were Greeks notorious for making smoke?
Well, in case this should ever be listened to by any Greeks, I would say with affection, the answer is yes, but with affection. They did have some, well, they had some pretty shaky ships, but we were not, as you know, we were not overburdened with merchant ships at the time. They were being sunk in vast numbers and every ship counted. But it was, of course, if a ship made a lot of smoke, it was a very dangerous situation because it homed the U-boats. It was more a gesture of amusement, perhaps, that the question was usually asked, are there any Greeks? And a plea, P-L-E-A, was usually made by the commodores of convoys to be very careful indeed not to give away the position of the convoy.
How did your convoy go off?
Well, in the Western Atlantic, which is where we were, our job was to get the convoys to mid-Atlantic, where they were taken over by real escort groups of highly professional British destroyers and corvettes as well, for the journey from the middle of the Atlantic to Europe. Our biggest problem was with fog and icebergs, and if you get both at the same time, it is a terrifying experience. If you can feel, you can, if you're on the bridge of a ship and there's an iceberg in the vicinity, you can feel the cold. And if you have a situation with ships, vast numbers of merchant ships, plowing through the fog, particularly in the earlier part of the war when radar was still in its infancy and half the ships had no radar in any case, the decision whether or not to try to avoid an iceberg in fog is a very difficult decision to make. The decisions in those circumstances rested with the commodore of the convoy, not, of course, with the escort vessels. So I would take the Montgomery alongside the commodore's ship and shout to the old boy who was in charge, my elder and better, "Sir, do you think we should alter course?" And the old boy would say, "If we alter course, we will lose two or three ships inevitably from collision. If we do not alter course, we may lose one or two ships on the icebergs. I think we should go on." And that was the decision that was usually made in those circumstances. But it was a harrowing experience, and in many ways more agonizing than meeting a U-boat, where at least you knew what you were dealing with. It was a privilege to be in that position at that age, and again, another experience that I will never forget.
Did the convoy get through safely to the mid-Atlantic?
We had turned the convoys over to the real escort groups from the UK, we then usually took over a convoy of empty ships and took them back to the United States. And there was a sort of routine whereby some would be detached and go into Halifax, some would be detached and go into Boston, Massachusetts, and the rest would go on to New York. It was quite a routine matter.
But there were no major mishaps on that convoy.
No. We were very fortunate.
Any other experiences that you had with Montgomery?
Yes. A ridiculous one. The final experience is when the Scharnhorst and Gneisenau were going up the channel, and I made an absurd signal to the Admiralty. I forget the actual wording. It was something like "not to worry," which is an asinine remark. But the two battle cruisers, they'd broken out of Brest, I think I remember, and I was bringing the Montgomery and a four-stacker, which was like all the others, full of holes. The Newport, I forget its name, but anyway, there were two four-stackers approaching the UK, and we heard that the two German battle cruisers had broken out of Brest, and I made a signal to the other four-stacker. I mean, this is ridiculous, but fun. I said, "You will attack the battle cruisers, and I will lay off and report their position. If you are not successful, I will attack, and you must lay off and report their position. It is absolutely essential that the Admiralty be informed where these characters are, but if we can slow one of them down, that will be fabulous." This was treated with respect and a certain amount of apprehension by my fellow four-stacker, but sadly, we were not to become involved.
Where were you at the time?
Where?
Where was the ship at the time?
Well, approaching Europe. I can't remember the exact position. Because the fascinating thing is that in a situation like that, you can only do one of two things, i.e. ram the battle cruiser or cross its bows and drop all your depth charges. Because with one miserable little gun and a ship with very thin plating, there's not much else that you could have done.
Now, I think we're coming now towards D-Day and a different ship that you went to. Can you tell me about that, please?
Well, yes. As you know, the D-Day was postponed one day because of the weather. On the final, I had a ship called the Dacres, which was a United States built escort vessel, a small frigate, which had electric main engines. That's important, as you'll see in a minute. We had rehearsed approaching dark coastlines with no lights for weeks on end in Scotland so that we could find our way when we came to the day. The night before the invasion, I should mention that we were supposed to be leading the assault division, the assault brigade, the assault brigade at Sword Beach, that is the British eastern end of the assault area. To lead the invasion was quite something. The night before D-Day, my chief engineer came to me and said, "Excuse me, sir, but there's a terrible drama." And I said, "Well, go on." He said, "You know we have electric main engines." And I said, "Of course." He said, "Well, the fire main, that is the salt water main round the ship, has burst and it has filled one of our engine rooms." I had to telephone Admiral Ramsay's staff, this is the night before D-Day, remember, and say, "Excuse me, sir, I am supposed to be leading the party tomorrow and I only have one engine. Can you tell me which way the wind will be blowing, because I might not be able to steer straight? There was a deathly hush for a moment, and I was told to hold on the telephone. A few minutes later, I was told that we would have to be relegated, I suppose is the word, to the intermediate brigade, because they could not have a ship leading the entire British part of the invasion with only one propeller. This is very sad. Not that it makes any difference, but it would have been lovely to have led the assault brigade to Normandy. As it happened, the wind was in the right direction and we did steer straight, but we took over 185 British Infantry Brigade, which was the intermediate brigade, which touched down a few minutes later than the first assaulting brigade. Subsequently, we acted as a traffic policeman off the beach, which was a fascinating experience. There were two of us, another frigate acting as captain southbound, meaning that every ship that arrived from the UK reported to that ship and was told to take whatever it was, ammunition, men, fuel, whatever, supplies, tanks, whatever, to a particular beach or to Wisserum or whatever. And we were captain northbound. We collected the empty ships, formed them into convoys and sent them back to the UK to reload. So there were the two traffic policemen, ourselves and another frigate, off the beach after the assault. It was a fascinating experience. We had a flag of every one of the United Allied Nations on a stave on the bridge, and as the French coaster would go past, we would wave the tricolour or whatever. It was a terrific party. We were never damaged, actually, during the assault, and it was just like a huge picnic. Not so, of course, for the unfortunate chaps who had to wade ashore and fight for their lives. It was a great privilege to be there. If I can just comment on one other aspect which always fascinated me, the enormous hunks of concrete which formed the breakwater, as you know, they were sunk to form a breakwater, had been put together in various little harbours all over the UK, and they were towed at a few knots by a tug or whatever, 600 miles to the French coast. It is quite extraordinary that you look at the operation orders and it said so-and-so would arrive or whatever, and these enormous hunks of concrete which had been towed at 4 or 5 knots for days should arrive within minutes of their appointed time off the French coast. That was, I think, one of the most amazing pieces of work in the whole of the invasion. We were sitting in the middle of the operation watching everything, everybody coming and going, and it was the most amazing experience.
Did you get the other engine going? The other engine, did you get it going?
Well, no, but it didn't matter, because we were perfectly capable of getting from A to